Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Binge all episodes of The Last City ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
To me, the truth is always, you know, the utmost importance for me in doing any character. But I find that genre interesting because it's extreme. Fanatics. Everyone's got their thing.
Guys, you've been so patient. It happened. It's David Zayas. I could say that it wasn't, but you know it because when you clicked on this episode, you saw in the title that David Zayas loves psychological thriller films. So you know that the special guest is David Zayas, who, of course, was Detective Angel Batista from the original Dexter series. He has now made an appearance here in Dexter New Blood. Appearing as well today is me, David Magadoff, who plays Teddy Reed. And of course, my wonderful co-host, the most amazing Claire Kramer. Hi, Claire.
And I just play myself. Hi.
Well, I'm playing me today, too.
You're playing you. But, you know, Teddy is such a fun character. It must be really fun to learn to do all the interesting cop stuff that you get to do, right?
Thank you, Claire. It is. In this episode, I do handcuff the character who plays Miles, the drug dealer. In real life, they were like, all right, David.
I don't want to hear about your real life handcuffing experience, David.
In my filmed life handcuffing experience, the real life stuff I'll text you later, Claire.
Okay, great.
It's not as vivid as you think. So what I got to do was I got to learn how to handcuff a guy, and they had me like bring up the prop master would like lay on the ground, the dirty ground outside the cabin or the bar, the crystal bar that we were outside, and I felt so bad for this guy, but he's like, no, go for it. And I started like handcuffing him. And it's hard to handcuff somebody, Claire. Have you ever, I mean, I don't want to get too detailed, but like, unless he had chubby wrists. And he even told me, he's like, I got big wrists. And it's when you have big wrists, it's kind of hard to.
I mean, they should make for theatrical purposes, they should make different size handcuffs. You know what I mean? Like, okay, we got a big guy in here. Let's get the jumbos out. You
know? This is a one size fits all thing, apparently. And so anyway, I learned to do it. I felt great about it. I did it. And then, of course, the way it was shot, I love Marcos. It's a beautiful episode. By the way, we're going to have Marcos Siega, the director, on next week to talk about episode 6. So no spoiler there, just excitement. But he did shoot it wonderfully, but did shoot it in a way where you'd have no idea that I'm handcuffing anybody. But
it's just well, like, you probably got the coverage, but you know, it ended. Teddy's handcuffing wasn't so pertinent to the episode, so sadly, it was lost. But you know what? Let's cross our fingers it comes out on like the bonus DVD or you know, the Blu-ray.
Well, let's talk about things that were pertinent to this wonderful episode 5, Claire.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start off by saying you mentioned the director. I thought the kill party scene where Harrison takes the ecstasy and then takes the oxy knockoff blue pill was phenomenally shot. I was really blown away. I have not seen such. He must be a fan of the movie Go. Have you ever seen Go?
Yes. Okay. That is a very. I'm glad you're mentioning this, by the way, because this was also my favorite moment. He really lingered on Harrison's that Steadicam. It was just clearly attached to Jack Alcott, the actor. It was really beautifully shot.
It was wonderful. I actually felt like it's been many years since I've been on the party scene. I don't want to shock anyone, but you know, I have a different life now. But I really felt like I was like back in New York at the limelight, like living it up with my glow sticks and my Vicks rub. And and I was immersed in that sensation. And that is awesome filmmaking or movie making or television making, whatever. I think the line is so blurred nowadays, you know, you can't really delineate between film and television except in time. So I really appreciated the time that he took with that scene. And of course, Jack was amazing. He is killing it as Harrison. I'm loving it. I love that scene.
All the puns intended.
Did you have any particular thoughts other than what I've said about that moment in the show?
It's a great moment. I like the idea of a... I also just remember when I was reading the script, just this idea that there would be a party for all the people who are on a list. Like a kill list party is both like this really fun, funny, odd, sad concept that I thought was just like the idea of it is just a great, mm-hmm. a great thing to put in the show. Mm-hmm. I just like this group of people who are now bonded in this weird way, because in their minds, they were a part of this kill list. And I guess it's on some level, you're like, yeah, I guess there is this, it's not quite a survivor or survivor mentality. You know, the idea of like what happens to the person who walks away from the train wreck when other people don't. But they always tell you, you know, what those people do walk away with a little bit of a trauma to associate it. And so,
well, they're young.
It's fun that as a teenagers, they're like, let's have a party.
Yeah, they're teenagers. They're going to party it up. I like it. I liked everything about that scene. I thought it was great. Harrison, interestingly, okay, so I was kind of thinking about episode 4, The H is for Hero, and thinking about, like, in this episode, we see Dexter, Jim Dexter, find the, like, straight blade that Harrison yeah. used in the attack on Ethan. And funny enough, it was a straight blade that the Trinity Killer used to kill Rita in the episode where young Harrison is left, much like his father was when Dexter's mom was killed, left in the bathroom with Rita massacred, waiting for someone to come discover her dead body and rescue him. So he's gone back. I don't know if it was from listening to the Mary Fucking Kill podcast or what, but he's got this straight blade. We don't know when he got it. And that was his weapon of choice. So I thought that was interesting.
Oh yeah. They're great. They're great with the callbacks and the themes for the original series, which of course is what every fan keeps looking for, which is why it's so great to have David Zayas appear in this episode.
Yes. I mean, okay, that was definitely, even though I knew he was going to be in the episode.
We did. We knew.
We did. Yes. But I kind of lost track about, you know, was he in episode 7, 6, 5? So I was still surprised to see him. It was a great way. It was really the only reason the girls, you know, went to New York, I felt. You know what I mean? So he could have that moment. So I'm kind of hoping, because it was classic Angel behavior, a little bit of flirty, a little bit of like,
yeah, the
whoa,
flirting. Yeah, the flirting with the strong boss.
The Me Too movement is now here. So Angel's got to tone it down a little bit. You know, I don't know if he'd survive as well. But it's classic Angel. He hasn't really changed that much. You could see a sadness in him from what happened in the past. I like that. I like that he's on the circuit now lecturing and like passing on his knowledge. I hope that we see him. I hope he helps Detective Bishop more. You know, I hope we get to see him. I don't know if we will. You don't have to say, David, because I'm like the viewing audience out there. I do not know what's happening. So I would say that to me, otherwise the trip for Molly and Bishop was kind of like, they bonded a little bit. Yeah, we know Molly likes spas and she likes to like do her thing. But I didn't really, it was kind of like filler in a way, that whole sure. storyline. But then the moment that David appeared made it obviously worthwhile. So.
Oh, yeah. He's such a pleasure, to have on this podcast. He's as charming in real life persona, as you guys will see very soon, as he is on the show. And he was a cop. He was a cop. Anyway, we'll get to David Zayas.
Yes, we'll get to him.
I also really loved in this episode, I don't know how you feel, Claire, I love seeing Kurt. Now that we know that Kurt is a not so nice guy, aka a serial killer, just seeing how he goes about doing his things and seeing the psychological issues that he deals with on a daily basis, of how he, you know, when he goes dancing in the bar, when he's feeling great, that he just got a new girl.
The Runaway, the song, too, is like,
yeah,
ooh, creepy.
And then when she doesn't do the things that he wants her to do and how he gets frustrated, it's a really, it kind of, is it fun for you? It creeps me out. It gets tingles because you're just like, what is the profile of a serial killer? And they probably really, you know, this show more than any really understands the profiles of serial killers and has fun with it.
Well, I think, okay, so last week we talked about how this whole arc for Dexter is about the father-son relationship, right? And relationships in general. I'm feeling like that's the overtone of like what Dexter's lesson in these 10 episodes is going to be, is how to manage relationships. Because he failed with that back in Miami. So I like the juxtaposition of Kurt Caldwell, who is not, has never learned to control his dark passenger, who doesn't have any sort of system. He has a regiment that he does. I like that they have him in his, you know, the ski mask and the sniper white camo, because it speaks to the same way Dexter puts on, you know, the butcher apron and the gloves and everything. They both have their routines, but yes. Kurt's is based out of just pleasure, and Dexter's is based on a system of his own morals and ethics, but also, you know, also a system to not get him caught. So I really find it interesting that they're taking both these characters and bringing them. Harrison is like the bottom of that little trifecta triangle there, and both of them are trying to influence Harrison. Kurt from, you know, an untrained killer point of view, Dexter from his training that he went through with his father to control his dark passenger. I also think it's interesting, and I don't know if you kind of picked up on this, before Kurt ever kills the girls, he gives them money, a way to leave. He offers them a job.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, well, fine. If you can't help yourself, I don't know. There's something there. I haven't identified it, but it did make me a little nervous at the end when he gave a job application to Harrison, because I feel like he's going to bring Harrison in. He wants to bring Harrison to his side of what's happening. And Dexter is trying, with Deb's help, is trying to save Harrison from demise by the dark passenger. David, yeah. Thoughts?
Did he just lose a son and he's trying to sort of help another young boy in the way that he couldn't help his son? Or is this something that he is doing on his serial killer?
It's a serial killer. He doesn't want to kill Harrison, though. He wants to bring Harrison over to have a, you know, a partner in crime. Now,
or
who
does
knows?
He?
Who knows? Well, this is my hypothesis.
Matt, I do like the Claire theories. Yeah. They always make me smile.
Matt, his real son, was too rebellious to ever be trained. He never had the fear of Kurt. He didn't have the fear of that father-son relationship. And so I don't think he was ever able to open up to Matt. But I think Kurt realizes that there's a moment to do that, a way to do that with Harrison, and to have to mimic that relationship he wished he could have had with Matt.
Yes, I think that's what I'm watching. That's what I'm seeing.
Okay.
Yeah. And I love that our two serial killers both did not get what they want this episode. They both, it got botched for each of them.
Yes.
You know, and I thought that was fun to see that motif and just see that, you know, that symmetry.
And also that Dexter considered it a sacrifice that he couldn't kill in his normal way. He had to like pretend it was a drug overdose.
Well, they both want a certain serial killers, as we learned with this show more than anything, in a safe, interesting way, and versus actually doing it ourselves. We get to watch these wonderful writers kind of take us through what happens when serial killers don't get what they want. And I'm sure, you know, it's incredibly unsatisfying. But what is satisfying is the rest of this episode, because we have on, like I said, David Zayas from Oz, Law & Order, Dexter, Gotham, Bloodline, Blue Bloods. And he's going to talk with us about psychological thriller films, which does include a lot of serial killer films, my friends. So this is a real,
you can say it,
happy serial killer Dexter kind of day for you. So please enjoy. David, do you own a panic room?
Well, I have a little like man cave, which is kind of like my panic room. But except for my
That's
wife,
your emotional panic
yeah,
room.
except that my wife can walk in anytime she wants, basically. That's so it's, I don't know how much of a panic room it is, but, yeah, I have a little room for myself.
That's nice. That's good.
You can call it an emotional panic room. Okay. Just to be clear, today we are talking about David's love of psychological thrillers, not slashers, not horror movies, not Halloween movies, not anything with maybe, you know, a big apparent ghost or a Tim Burton movie, but a psychological thriller. How do you define a psychological thriller, David?
You know, here's how I define it. So my dad, who's no longer with us, told me that his first date with my mom was in 1960 to see Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. So me just being fascinated by that as a kid, I went to see Psycho. In movies in Manhattan back in the 70s used to have these old movies where they used to show old movies, and I used to go to a lot of them. And I saw Psycho, and that is probably the first film that I said, oh, this is not just a horror movie. This goes deep. I'm interested in this. This goes deep. You know, and since then, I've been able to identify the ones that are my favorites, and I revisited it when I got cast in Dexter, because I was like, if I'm playing a general dictator, I have to go and study dictators, and I just like to know what's going on in their minds, you know. So it's when I got Dexter, I said, oh, and I started watching all these other films that I had watched, I've seen before, but now I'm looking at it in a different way.
I think you just actually gave the best definition of psychological thriller I've ever heard. And I don't even think you know you did it, but but it's when it's a human preying on a human.
Yes.
Versus like a natural disaster, or versus, you know, a spirit, or, you know, something where suspension of disbelief is required. Right. With a psychological thriller, there is no suspension of disbelief. No. It could happen.
Yes.
It could happen, which is why, oh my gosh, you're like the luckiest artist in the world to get to work on something in the genre that you absolutely love.
Yes.
So diverging for just one second, when you were cast in the original Dexter run, and you started doing this research, what was going on in your mind, David?
Well, you know, I auditioned for Dexter, and when I got called to go to LA to test for it, I immediately bought the book, Darkly Dreaming Dexter, and I read the book. And I'm like, oh my God, I love this book. This book goes deep into, like, you know, it was violent, but it was also very psychological. And, you know, it just reminded me when I was young and I read Silence of the Lambs, you know, the Thomas Harris novel, Silence of the Lambs. I couldn't put it down. It was fascinated. So yeah, that was what it was. I auditioned, and then I read the book, and I went in an audition, and I was lucky enough to get cast in it.
Would you be more excited to read the script when it came in, or would you be more excited to be on set?
Both. I mean, you know, I've been on shows that reading the script is an event because you don't know what's going to happen to your character. So, you know, I was on a show, Oz, about prison, and every script we'd be like, am I getting killed? Am I getting raped? When am I happening? What's going on?
I
made it through this episode. And on Dexter, because my role was outside of the mentality of a serial killer, but it was interested to read the script to see, you know, how I could not see it. My character could not see it. So that's what I was looking for when I started getting scripts every week. Like, is he purposely ignoring the truth, or seeing, you know, evidence, and not because Dexter was a friend of Angel Batista? I don't know, but it was that I found reading those scripts, that's what I was looking for.
Is it a practice of yours? Because it is a practice of mine. If something's being made into a film and there's a book, I like to read the book first, and then I like to go see the film. So do you tend to make a practice of that, or are those just kind of anomaly situations?
No, I like to read the book, except for Dexter. I didn't know there was a book. I wasn't aware.
I actually didn't either until right now. And I'm like going to order it as soon as we're done with this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, he does a lot of all the D's. Dearly Devoted Dexter, Darkly Dreaming Dexter. You know, so that's what he does. But I mean, when I read the pilot for the series first, and then I'm like, I gotta learn more about this. So I bought the book, which, by the way, the book has all the characters, but it's a different story than the series, you know. So
Michael's character, Dexter, is now called Jim Lindsay in the new Dexter New Blood, which is a homage to Jeff, the author Jeff Lindsay of the book. So it's fun.
By the way, his only cameo was a scene with me in a hospital. Jeff Lindsay was in one of the scenes, a little cameo.
Good guy?
Very good guy.
That's fun.
Very, very smart man.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, so you mentioned Psycho. You mentioned Silence of the Lambs. What are the things that really attract you to the psychological thriller? Like, what components does the film need to have? Because there's certainly a lot of failed attempts at psychological thrillers out there. Does it need to be based on a true story? Does the lead character need certain traits that somehow make them endearing even though they're evil? Like, what are your thoughts?
My thought is it doesn't have to be actual events, because I've read some scripts and some books of actual events that kind of lean towards the slash. It just didn't grab me. I think what I really look at is, can I identify with that guy? Is he likable in some way? How does he distribute his mental awareness of what he's doing? You know, those are the things that interest me. And also the other side of how does law enforcement actually track these people down and what it entails. It could entail a law enforcement official to kind of have that kind of sick thoughts that a serial killer might have. And so that's the kind of, that's what, if I like the character, I'm more interested in him because of all the horrific things that he or she does, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you love to just guess along the way, or do you try to shut that part of your brain off when you're watching?
No, I'm able to compartmentalize everything while I'm watching. Like, what did these law enforcement people do that I wouldn't do, or what, you know, or something that I thought of? I don't usually put myself in the serial killer's mind, because I want to discover that as I'm watching it. Yeah, I want to be surprised in watching it. You know, what I try to really get comfortable with is the steps to catch them. You know, that's interesting to me.
I definitely agree with the steps to catch them. Like, that's like its own like science, you know. Mm-hmm. That's why I've watched Forensic Files, like the original, you know, science show since way back, a couple decades ago. But the thing about the, I don't want to say hero character, the antagonist, protagonist, it's kind of like a combination when you're talking about a psychological thriller, I guess, sometimes, is it does lead you to think of like where we can go as humans.
Right.
Like, we all have so much social conditioning and we all have so many societal rules and also our own morals and ethics. Mm-hmm. But these people seem to be able to like just, I don't know, their ego allows them. So what is it about like that sort of study of that mind frame that appeals to you?
Right. To me, what I've noticed in all the script, all the movies that I've seen about it and all the books that I read about it, is they have a very high regard for justification. what I find interesting is, like, for example, you know, Dexter kills, and he usually kills people that have gotten away with something, you know, and
so his father taught him a code.
A code.
There's a code.
There's a code.
Yes.
But really, the code is just an act that they want, because if you're going to do that, you're all screwed up and you're crazy anyways. Yes, it's a code. I never believed that Dexter believed in the code. I always felt that he used that to just to stay out of the limelight somewhat, you know, and not get caught.
A convenient excuse, maybe.
Yeah, kind of, you know.
Well, the code fit society's excuse that allowed him. So it really wasn't about him. It was really about his father coming to terms with the fact that his son was a killer, and how do I justify that being okay and not turning him in?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Which is why the dad keeps and now I'm curious with Dexter's son, mm-hmm. which they showed in the trailer mm-hmm. for this season, Dexter New Blood. Has the dark passenger been passed on? I don't know yet.
I don't know. The apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, though. But you never know. But you never know. No, I don't. I know nothing about the new, the whole storyline of Dexter.
David, do you know what happens
in the new one?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Between you and me and whoever's listening,
I honestly don't know what happens, because
I'm excited to talk to you at the end, because I know what happens, and so I'm very curious to see what your thoughts are on it. So we'll do a recap.
Yeah, cool. I got just basic information and then I went and did my scenes, and you know, that would I have no idea.
Nice. So you get to be a fan on this.
Yes, I look forward
to
it.
Nice. You get to enjoy the psychological thriller of it.
Right. And see, knowing that character so well, I'm gonna find it even more interesting. Because I want to see how that aligns with the first 8 years that we did the show. And has he learned anything from that? Has he, you know, what is his mental state? I'm interested to see all that. I don't know any of that.
Cool.
Yeah. Aside from Dexter, it does seem like one of the predominant traits of people who are willing to kill, or people who are willing to capture, or, you know, torture, is just a huge inflated ego and what people commonly refer to as narcissism, which I think is a term that's thrown around way too much, you know. But I don't know. What do you think about that trait being a unifying trait?
For you to be a serial killer, I don't think you need to be a narcissist. I don't believe that. I mean, a narcissist can be a CEO of a big company. Narcissism is not it's not permission to do violent acts and to kill people. I never looked at it as that. Yes, ego, I feel, has more of an impact than, you know, narcissism. The ego, which is part of the definition, but I always found that I never felt Dexter was a narcissist. That's just, you know, my opinion.
All right, Stephen King.
Yes.
What do we think of his movies?
Or books?
A lot of them are great. I love Stephen King. You know, like Pet Sematary and Misery, and you know, and then he's written like Shawshank Redemption or The Green Mile. You know, so he goes deep also, and the great thing about reading a Stephen King book that you can't really, it's almost impossible to get 100% of that in a movie, is he goes into the minds of his characters, into the minds. So when you're reading, you kind of read what they're thinking. In movies, you just see what they're doing, you know? And so I think Stephen King is a genius. You know, he's not the one that directs or writes even the screenplays of his movies, but his books are awesome. Yeah.
The extended version of The Stand is one of my all-time favorite books.
Yeah.
I love it. I agree. He's a genius. And Thinner, one of his lesser known properties, mm-hmm. is probably one of the biggest psychological thrillers, about losing, like, just crazy. Anyway, David, go ahead. I know you have more.
I'm going to give you a rapid fire. You ready?
A what? Go ahead. Go for it.
A rapid fire. And you can say pass if you hadn't seen the movie, or you can give me a quick, like, hey, 1 minute or 1 second, you know, review of it real fast.
Okay.
That's my hope, is you've seen a lot of these. How about Gone Girl?
Gone Girl, that's Fincher, right? Fincher directed that?
Yep.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Fincher because he keeps the suspense in everything that he does. So yeah, I found it to be suspenseful I kind of was a little dissatisfied with how it ended or the twist of it.
Yeah.
It just didn't have enough scenes to earn that twist, in my opinion. You know,
you didn't love it. It's fine. We're not here. Right, right. I'm not David Fincher. All right. Cape Fear.
Which one? The old one or the new one?
The original with Juliette Lewis.
That's not the original. The original is with Gregory.
Yeah, that was the De Niro one. Right. The original.
It's with Gregory Peck. Yeah, the original one, I felt with Robert Mitchum and Gregory Peck was brilliant. And Cape Fear, the Martin Scorsese directed one from 1991, Robert De Niro just was amazing in it. You know, it was a chance to create a character and he transformed his body. And, you know, I like the older one, the older version better because they just kept in it was more psychological in the 1962 one.
De Niro definitely played it overtly, but like the part where he's on the undercarriage of the car and you're like, what is going on? Yeah. He is like clinging onto that car for miles and miles. It's an amazing movie. So
I love both versions of it. The 1962 one, I was able to like just kind of relax and observe the behavior of the insane Robert Mitchum character, you know. But yeah, Cape Fear is one. I like it.
Solid.
Yeah, solid.
All right, going with Fear. How about Primal Fear?
Primal Fear, I didn't really look at it in that category.
Me neither.
I mean, that the transformation. See, that's the thing. The transformation of Edward Norton in that scene when he actually just changes his personality, that was earned because it actually, I didn't know anything about the film when I went to see it. And I was like, okay, is this guy innocent? Maybe he was forced to do it by somebody. And then I realized, oh no, he's psychotic. He's definitely, there's something going on with this kid. And it's scary because, you know, you know that they're out there in real life, you know, that it could just in a drop of a dime, it could switch over. But another one I really enjoyed, Primal Fear was very good.
Single white female.
Single white female, I thought was very interesting, but it was more of a someone who is just obsessed with someone else. And in that obsession causes her to kill people. But it's not, to me, I didn't find her to be a serial killer, even though in definition, maybe she was, but it was more about the obsession of
becoming
being,
the other
right,
person.
The other person.
Yeah. So we're narrowing it down, I think, to serial killers. Is this what we're sort of, it's maybe a little less of a psychological thriller and more you like serial killer based thrillers?
No, not really, because listen, Jason from Friday the 13th is a serial killer, and it's, to me, it doesn't have the substance, in my opinion, the substance of what leads them or how they could identify with the audience. When you go see Friday the 13th or Halloween, Mike Myers, you're just getting ready to see a bloodbath because that's what's going to happen. So, but, you know, and they touch on the psychological, but it's not strong enough to actually consider them, because they are serial killers, but it's not, I don't really put it in that category.
Does there have to be a twist?
No.
And is it more fun if there is one?
It's more fun. It's fun if there is one, but it doesn't have to be. Like Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which was in the mid-80s. You know,
so good.
It's so good. But it's slow.
Michael Rooker is so good in that.
But it's amazing. It's a slow progression. It's not, there's no, I don't feel that there's any twist. You know what this guy is in the beginning of the movie, and you know what he is at the end of the movie. And it's the actions that he takes and his interactions with, you know, friends or people that are close to him. I mean, that was a very interesting film about psychological serial killers, I believe.
Is M. Night Shyamalan's films in the category of the psychological thriller for you, or not quite?
They are, but not serial killers or anything like that, or not murderers, or not something that switches someone You know, like Psycho was a twist. You know, I knew a lot about it before I went in to see it, so it wasn't that shocking to me. But I could imagine in 1960, the twist of what they saw. But no, it doesn't have to be. It could be a psychological thriller that doesn't have a serial killer that I find. And like a lot of Brian De Palma films have a lot of twists and a lot of psychological drama into it. You know, it usually involves death and murder, you know, but not always. And I'm trying to think of a film that may not have had that. That's
well, how about this, David? You're talking to 15-year-old me, or how about current me? Mm-hmm. And you're just like, hey, David, you have to see these three. These are the three psychological thrillers that you have to see before you die. What are they?
I would say if you were 15, I would say the first thing you should see is Psycho, American Psycho, which is like, that's something that
Bret Easton Ellis. Yeah.
Right. And there's a film by David Fincher that it's a true account of Zodiac, called Zodiac, from 2007, that David Fincher also directed with Mark Ruffalo. And that movie kind of gives you a template on, you know, the investigation, the law enforcement side of tracking down this killer. And I found that to be really interesting. So it would be those three, I would say. Psycho, American Psycho, and Zodiac.
I love it. Yeah. And how often are you watching these movies? Will you just turn them on while you're cooking, or do you have to be sitting and focused?
No, I'm a movie buff. I am a big Turner Classic Movie, so I watch everything. It's not just this. But this is something that I felt, this subject is something that I really looked into when I got cast in Dexter. You know, I wouldn't say, oh, that's the top of my list. You know, because I like, you know, dramas, comedies. I'm, you know, across the board movie lover. You know, but when I do get I'm lucky enough to get a role, I really, dive into trying to find out something inside. And what better way than movies? And what quicker way than movies? But when I watch a movie, I just watch it. I don't want to be interrupted. I'm not cooking while I'm watching it. I'm watching it, and sometimes I'll rewind moments to see, did I miss something there? And I'll rewind it. And so I really study it when I watch movies, regardless of what the movie is.
With your research that you've done in this arena, have you come across a character either in a novel or perhaps, you know, a nonfiction character that you read a news article about where the property hasn't been adapted yet and you could see it being adapted and you could see yourself playing that lead character?
Oh, you mean like in real life, like some that I've read in
real life, or it could be a fiction book, right? Either way. But I want to know, do you have a character in mind in this genre that you want to play eventually that has not been done?
That has not been done. Wow. You know, I don't look at it like what's not been done. I just think about what fascinates me is the take and how they tell the story. Mm-hmm. How they tell, like, for example, there's this Netflix show called Mindhunters, and it goes to every serial killer that happened. It has these two guys examining each serial killer, whether it's Ed Kempner or, you know, the different. You know, it was a fantastic show, and I found it so fascinating from the law enforcement side, how FBI, how did they break everything down? Why is one thinking one way, and then the other one is more intent into trying to get into that, like, you know, what makes them tick? What makes them tick? And sometimes it'll take the law enforcement person into a dark side, you know, because in order to get into that mindset, you have to really, you know, commit yourself. And so that's I think, to me, the ideal role I would like to play is someone who is not just after to catch them, you know, is to actually explore the mind of this person. And in doing that, then you're able to catch them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what like the Jodie Foster character in Silence of the Lambs.
I was just going to say, would you rather be Jodie Foster or Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs?
I'd rather be Jodie Foster. It shows so many things because there was such a courageous character, such a character that actually, but it did not, you know, it wasn't, she wasn't Dirty Harry. She was a nervous wreck, especially towards the end of that film.
Oh, that scene where she's like in the dark, can't see, the well and isn't there. She's a, what, like, it's crazy.
Because you know, someone like, you know, Clint Eastwood, they just be really cool and collect. She was like, she was like, you know, just terrified, which is what the reality would be. So to me, real, always more powerful to me than just something outrageous, something that, that, you know, it's it has to do with what you're thinking, not what you're doing.
Would you ever play the killer?
I would. I play a lot of bad guys. It's, I either play a cop or a bad guy. It's not very, there's very little I play, but yes, I do. And in doing that, I always try to play the opposite of what the obvious would be. You know, I always try, okay, this is the obvious. Or I'm playing this bomb expert. It's obvious I could play, you know, but what is he thinking? What's not obvious? And that is what I try to explore, sometimes successfully and sometimes unsuccessfully. That's just the way it is.
You know? I think more successfully. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
So your respect for the film is quite evident and quite beautiful. And thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
And so I think you'll respect this question because of the nature of what we're talking about. So I always like to get into the why. Like, why do you love psychological thrillers? And I think you touched on it a little, where your dad took out your mom to see Psycho, on the most romantic of dates many years ago.
Hey.
Would you say that really sticks with you as to what love is about? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Right. If you had to analyze why you keep coming back to serial killer movies, psychological thrillers, what is it that is scratching your itch? What is it that makes you feel comfortable probably in those moments?
Well, I'll preface that answer by saying that, I was a New York City police officer, you know, for 15 years, and then I went into acting. So I was a cop in New York, and even before I became an actor, I was always interested in the mind of someone that can do something so horrible and something so, you know, brutal. When I had the opportunity to go into homicide, I also then discovered acting, and I decided to just put all my energy. I mean, I still worked as a cop. I did a midnight shift. And then during the day was all about my career in acting and trying to, you know, find, to me, the truth is always, you know, the utmost importance for me in doing any character. But I find that genre interesting because it's extreme. I mean, I like sports movies. I like love stories. I like romantic comedies too, you know. And you can go deep in that if it's well done. But the whole psychological aspect of movie making or movie watching, it's not even about shock value, because the Deer Hunter, that Russian roulette scene in the Deer Hunter, as shocking as it was, I understood the situation that they were in, and I just wanted to see what they were, how they were going to react in that moment, how people react in the moment of extreme pressure and extreme danger. I find interesting how they handle it, how the actor handles that part is really interesting.
Well, and as an artist, those are the like most unique moments to prepare for. And I almost think like you can't really make any decisions about what you're going to do on camera, because in life, like you said, with Jodie Foster, that's what made that scene so believable, is her nervousness, is her anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't prepare for those big, big moments. I think you just have to go in, and if you're riding the wave of the character and the situation, then whatever comes out, that's mm-hmm. how the character would have reacted. That's how a human would have reacted.
Absolutely. And it's truthful. Real truth comes in the darkness, right. Not in the light, in my opinion. You know, and so it's something that to go to that dark side, you know, it doesn't have to be serial killers. It could be a normal, you know, it could be Charles Bronson in Death Wish, that he's a business architect, he's a businessman, and something happens that triggers him into being a serial killer, because mm-hmm. that's what he was. And so it's always about, it's not about the result, it's about how mm-hmm. you get there, you know, when it comes to those kind of things.
I love it, you know? That's great, yeah. David. Wow. I love that your two loves of being a law enforcement officer, a policeman, and you've been able to do that, you know, and such a significant story, and you get to put yourself back in those shoes every time you watch these movies. I think it's very cool.
Absolutely. Cool. It's the human condition, you know, and the human condition is something interesting when it's not something that you've thought about, or if not something that your normal life has, you know. I'm surrounded by love. But, you know, I don't like, you know, my daughter's the same way. My daughter loved Reservoir Dogs when she was 8 years old. I didn't know she was watching it, right? But there's something that she has that I'm glad she's able to express, because if you keep it inside, you know, you don't know what's going to happen.
You know, you just hit the nail on the head. Also, it's like, I have a happy life. I'm a happy person. I'm very pretty much boring. When I sit down at night, I want to think about something other than the situations I'm going through in my life every day. And that is a psychological thriller.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, David. So we end every podcast with what we think is a beautiful moment, with a love letter. So if you'd be so kind as to share your love letter to psychological thrillers.
Dear psychological thriller, please keep me guessing. Please keep me trying to understand what's in your mind and how you avoid getting caught and your justification for doing the horrible things that you do, because I know it just doesn't come spontaneous. There's a lot of thought put into it. And I'm trying to get into your mind to see if there is something that's relatable that will then put me on that journey with you. And understand that I always try to find truth in everything that's done. Love, David.
I love it.
Beautiful. There was no twist at the end of that letter. It was just straight and good.
No twist. It was no twist.
That was great. That was really, really enjoyable.
Yes.
David.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Claire, one might say that was a thrill.
I can't even go there, David. you know, I actually share this affiliation. I do love this genre. I love reading the books. I love watching the movies. I also am a movie and TV person. I'll have it on in the background. I'll also have it on in the foreground. I you know, it doesn't matter. I love film and television, and this is definitely my favorite genre. When I want to relax and have a sense of escapism, I go to psychological thrillers. He mentioned Cape Fear. I have a funny story about Cape Fear. I auditioned for the Juliette Lewis role.
Oh.
Way back when. Yes. It was very early in my career, before I, you know, I was still a teenager in high school. But it was a crazy audition, and I remember it very clearly. in New York City, and clearly I did not get that role. But what wouldn't that have been crazy if I did?
That would have been great. We would have had Julia Lewis come on, and she would have been saying, "Oh yeah, the Claire Kramer movie."
Right. Yeah. She may be your co-host right been. Now.
She would have been like my co-host.
Trading places with Juliette Lewis.
If only. Sliding doors, Claire. Sliding doors.
What is one of your favorite psychological thrillers, David?
I think Usual Suspects is in that category. Yeah?
I think so. I mean, it's certainly on a list. I Googled some lists. It's definitely on a list. I don't know.
I love
if it...
the ending. I mean, if I really am all for the twist and the end. So what was he's like, yeah, it's nice to have a twist.
Kaiser Soze. Yeah.
Yeah. I live for the twist. I love an ending. I mean, Sixth Sense even, just like, oh my gosh, he's dead. I can enjoy a bad movie with a great ending. I really can.
Yeah.
But he was a great podcast convo with a great beginning, middle, and end. Wasn't he just the best?
I really love him.
I could listen to his accent
his
all day.
I loved his character from the original Dexter run, and I'm so thrilled that he was plucked out of that whole group to make a cameo this season.
Yeah, yeah, and it could have been anyone, and he's a delight. So
speaking of casting, I wonder how many people auditioned for Dexter. Like, I wonder, that's always interesting, isn't it? When you hear like that Eric Stoltz was the original, like Michael J. Fox in the Back to the Futures, or, you know, I know with Bring It On, there were several actors that were fired when we were in like the rehearsal process who couldn't do like the dancing and the cheers and stuff. So like, I wonder who, I mean, we'll never know, but I wonder who else was up for that role.
I feel like I could ask a couple of questions.
Because he's so perfect, Michael C. Hall. He's perfect as Dexter.
I think I'm going to ask a couple of questions. I think we can figure this out and put it in the podcast soon. So I know a few people. I think we'll get an answer to that. There won't be a twist ending on this one. We'll have a firm, confident end of who was
really?
There.
Sometimes now, they don't reveal that info, though, what? Because, you know, it's like kind of weird if somebody, you know, more well-known than Michael C. Hall at that time, although from Pushing Daisies or whatever, he was like really beloved.
6 feet under, but Pushing Daisies is, I feel like, the untitled, or I could see that being the original script title for 6 feet under. I like Pushing Daisies. That's a good one.
Maybe that was the book. I don't know. I don't know where I came up with that. Anyway, point is, Michael C. Hall is perfect as Dexter. Anthony Hopkins is perfect as Hannibal Lecter. Robert De Niro was perfect as the character in Cape Fear. And
David Zayas was perfect as Angel Batista.
David Zayas was absolutely perfect for being
my co-host.
And thanks, David. And you were almost perfect.
I'll take it. I'll take it.
You're clinging on the right there, you know?
I know. I need to work out a little more. I get it.
I'm just kidding. You're perfect.
And you guys are a perfect audience. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next Monday as we continue Fanatics, the Dexter episodes.
Woohoo! And before you guys go, coming up next week on Fanatics, the Dexter episodes, we have Johnny Sequoia. Yes, of course, Johnny is on Dexter New Blood, but you also know her from Believe, an American Housewife. And Johnny will be talking about her fanaticism for making pies. Thank you for listening to Fanatics, a Roddenberry podcast. For more episodes and info, head over to wearefanatics.com or tweet your Fanatics thoughts and stories at wearefanatics.
Yes, that's We Are Fanadicts. Our show is hosted by Claire Kramer and me, David Magadoff.
Produced by me, Claire Kramer, and Kelsey Goldberg. Executive producers Trevor Roth and Rod Roddenberry.
Our sound engineer and editor is Elizabeth Joy Windham. And you can thank Stephen Mudd for our theme song.
Catch us next Thursday for another Fanatics episode.
Sometimes podcasts are scary, which means ukulele songs need to be scary.
But not this one.
I like that, David.
See, I did a twist because of our conversation today.
It was good. It worked.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women had been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor, Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.